Sit as far back as I can and hold the phone.
Well, if you go as far back as you can, that would be our first appearance on Radio Free Oz.
Yes.
1966. Thank you very much.
What an irony!
Well, what we used to say, though, that, you know, we started in the 60s, and then we're in our 60s.
Oh. Yeah, that's not anymore.
I guess not. We were big in the 70s, and now we're in our 70s, right?
Well, I've gotten pretty big in my 70s. How hard I try, I can't get rid of this beer belly.
Well,
it's part of the aging process.
Yes, unfortunately it is. And I'm like a fine wine now. Fine wine filled with beer.
Well, hello everyone, and you guys and everyone in the room. Instead of playing the album this morning, which is basically like an exact duplicate of what you're going to hear in the movie, except for a couple of minor cuts, we figured it would be more interesting to get Mr. Proctor and Mr. Osmond on the phone, and we could just talk about their sci-fi history. And if you are in a position to be able to see my iPad at the front, just for Phil and Dave's reference, everyone's going to be looking at a slideshow of images from the production of Everything You Know Is Wrong and Martian Space Party and some other things too. Everything you see on this slideshow is going to be included on the DVD of Everything You Know Is Wrong, which we are going to kill ourselves if we have to, but it will be out in time for Christmas. It will have Everything You Know Is Wrong and Martian Space Party. There are new commentaries recorded for both movies that were recorded with a full group in 2009. There will be hours of home movies that nobody's seen before. The Dear Friends home movie synced to sound for the first time. So you can see Mr. Osmond say, "Era Dr. Whiplash." And the Jack Poet commercials from 1969. And for the first time, I know if you're a Firehead, you probably are aware of the mythology of the very first time Fireside ever did something together, which was November of 1966, when they went on Radio Free Oz and did the Oz Film Festival, in which they were told they could not project dirty movies on the radio, and people called in and insisted that they let them project dirty movies on the radio, at which point they knew they had a career. Well, there's no known recording of that, but in 68, they went on an L.A. public affairs show, the Les Crane Show, and did that act. And we had no known recording of that. There's no known video recording, but one of the guys in Firesign stood in front of his TV and recorded it on open reel. So that's going to be audio only on the DVD as well. And very exciting. So anyway, that's the tease for what's happening. But gentlemen, let's talk about Everything You Know Is Wrong first. David, you sent me a Word document. Maybe you just want to read from that.
I have to look it back up.
I'll read from it, and I'll read from it with David's voice.
Okay, you do that. The old man's voice or the young man?
In 1975, Parashine recreated their album Everything You Know Is Wrong as a short film called Boom-Ka-Choo, working with director of photography Alan Davio, who shortly after filmed E.T., Stands for Everything, headed around Harry Fox, can I say that on the speakerphone, a filmmaker specializing in New Age phenomena. The story takes Cox to Hellmouth, California, to cover Regis Canidas' jet shoe-powered leap to the center of the Earth, and eventually reveals that aliens, Dippo and Gorko, had everything under control. And it's very interesting because there's now a documentary out about Evil Knievel called, what's it called? The History of Evil is a, what's it called, honey? Being Evil.
Space.
Right, and of course, Evil Knievel was the one who inspired us to create the Regis Knievel character.
the record that we should borrow, and it doesn't look like it in the film. In the film, it looks like it's all a nice one big movie narrated by Phil Austin's great character, Harry Cox, who is a collector of all things New Age and was going to do this trailer cast, actually, although I won't say we exploited that very much in the movie, but you can use your imagination. So we started out really writing a movie about that character and about his discoveries, and we realized we just couldn't do a movie on a record. A record is 40 minutes long. And we took another look at the whole material and let the character, Happy Harry Cox, kind of narrate it through all of these various periods.
Yeah, well, and, this was kind of like a documentary.
Yeah, he was presenting a documentary, an audio documentary. But when you turn the record over, then reality takes over, and Zippo and Gorko, the aliens from outer space, actually are there, and he's wrong about everything. He knows it's wrong, and Race has got to watch the big jump, which is Rebus Knievus in our story. But of course, Evel Knievel was what we were writing. Evel Knievel was about to do his big jump. It wasn't the Grand Canyon. It was probably something else, and it failed miserably. But that was where that idea came from.
Well, it fails miserably the way Donald Trump's running for the nomination has failed.
You mean
because the people came out to watch the disaster unfold.
No? There you go.
Quite a while before the Bell Revolution, what's his name? The Coast to Coast Shop came on.
Art Bell.
And Art Bell, yeah. Also, Harry Cox is Art Bell in many
ways. Yeah, but this is where we go back with this piece to 19, with the album was recorded in 1974. And then at the same time as we were doing the album, we worked out with Columbia that we would do a film of it, and that we did very early in 1975. It was a really wonderful short movie, both this one and The Martian Space Party, which is us on stage performing at really our youthful peak. And I'm so glad we have it, because by this time we forgot what that youthful peak was all about. And we were really working enormously hard. By the way, Bill, I have to tell you that somebody posted online. Go online, everybody, and look at these bizarre videos that are out there. You're doing Nixon with
Dolphinathon.
You doing Nixon in Dolphinathon.
Oh, really?
Oh, wow.
Online, and you are fabulous, absolutely hysterical. They can't get you off the stage.
Well, that's what happened. We got Nixon off the stage finally, but it took a while.
So that's something for people to look on YouTube. There's a foursome that is an alternate Firesign Theater. That's me and Phil and Harry Shearer and George.
Oh, that's wonderful. Do you guys know if the LA Comedy All-Stars bit got on TV, where you're doing Dick Private, Private Dick?
The Comedy All-Stars.
Excellent.
Tell me,
how do you find these bits?
Here's the insight where everybody gets your notebooks out and write this down. Just simply go to it's just this little chromium switch.
Ah, right.
And they have just press videos, and it takes you right to the Fireside Theater section of YouTube, and there's 100 things. Just ignore the thanks for laying up all of our records online in any crummy condition, but I'm not going to complain about that, because there's so much unusual stuff there, and really check it out. It's quite a surprise to me.
Well, it's also funny because I just finished playing Richard Nixon again in an independent film called Sammy Gate, which is about Sammy Davis Jr.'s relationship with Nixon's administration. And it's by a wonderful, crazy filmmaker named Noel. I can't remember Noel's last name. I can't remember any last names today. This is rather shocking, but anyway, I'm going to have to look him up.
First thing to go.
Anyway,
we recorded this at at the Burbank Studios, which was really Warner Brothers. For a time, it became EBS, the Burbank Studios, but it was not a really beautiful, big, old Warner Brothers Studios with the giant sound stages and movies going on all the time and old staff to go look at. So it was a lot of fun just to be on the lot.
Do you remember that day when somebody brought a bear onto the lot when we were recording? Do you remember that?
Reminds me.
Yeah, well, we walked out for a lunch break or something, and there was this guy with a bear, you know, a muzzled bear lumbering along between sound stages. It was just everything we knew was wrong. Yeah, his name is Noah Lawrence. Noah Lawrence, and he's known as a cinematic provocateur. This is a guy who pretended to be a famous filmmaker and put together all of these crazy movies using found footage and documentary style, jazzed up stills and things. And for years, he traveled under an assumed name all over the world presenting his films. And then he finally decided that he's come out of the closet, right, or out of the can, and become himself. And this is his first film under his name, Noah Lawrence.
From time to time, that it's a cliche now that Firesign Theater was entirely predictive, but it's just breathtaking when you listen to Martian Space Party and you hear David shout, "One man, one channel." It's like, wait 30 years, and that's exactly what's happened.
That's right. Oh, yeah. There's so many other things that were predicted and are still predicted in our work. And I suppose that's, in many ways, that's one of the inspirations for science fiction. And certainly for me as a kid growing up, was one of the things that attracted me to the stories of Bradbury and Sturgeon and Dick and Asimov, all of them. I was an avid reader of all of the science fiction pulp magazines that were out at the time. And luckily later in my later life, primarily because of David, I got to meet Ray Bradbury.
That's right, you did. I had been his friend, and he was my friend since I was 16. And so, great influence on my entire life, and as a writer, and, you know, as a person dealing with fans, you know, I learned a lot from Bradbury. Open, always welcoming, always full of love for everybody who loved him, which is a marvelous man.
Well, I'll tell you another ironic story, which I suddenly remembered after he said that David was my introduction to Ray. In point of fact, I met Ray Bradbury at the opening of the musical The Amorous Flea in 1965, I think it was, out here in Los Angeles at the Las Palmas Theater. He was invited to our opening night performance. This was a show that I had done back in New York, and I won the Theater World Award for it, and we brought it out to the Las Palmas Theater in Los Angeles, and it was my introduction to Los Angeles. It's the reason I'm here now. Ray Bradbury was in the opening night audience, and at the party afterwards, where I met, by the way, the incredible Shrinking Man. This is the first Hollywood star I ever met. This little guy comes up to me and says, "Hi, I'm so-and-so, the incredible Shrinking Man." And I said, "You look so much bigger on the screen." And then I met Ray Bradbury. And one of the stories that Ray told me was, he said he liked the show very, very much. But he said, even if we didn't like it, we would not have walked out on the show. I said, "Well, why is that?" He said, "Well, the one time we decided to walk out on a show, my wife fell down in the aisle and broke her leg." I said, "Make it a story." It's another story. So actually, that was my first introduction to Ray, but I didn't get to really know him until I worked with him I think that, was it the history of radio? David, was that the show?
Yeah, we were doing a huge show called The Empire of the Air, which was the history of radio starting in 1906.
Mm-hmm.
And when the first broadcast happened, and going really through the 50s, it turned out that it was also about the invention of FM radio and how FM was stolen by television. And, you know, it was one of the great American tragedies. It's a really interesting story. So
forward into the past.
and Bradbury always used me. We liked to use Ray whenever he was available. He also did a 20-minute commentary on our production of The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, which of course was one of his
inspiration,
right? Yeah, and really an inspiration. And so we invited him in the studio and said, "Just tell us how you feel about Wonderful Wizard of Oz." And a great 20-minute piece that he did for it. So yeah, we loved him very much, and I think that's really part of the history of us in science fiction has a lot to do with what Bradbury dealt with so rigidly early on in his career, which was predicting the future, the near future.
That's right. And ironically, Ray did not drive a car.
No, he did not drive a car. He was always
a great futurist. He insisted on walking everywhere.
That's right.
You guys, can we?
In fact, he got a ticket for jaywalking in his own neighborhood once.
He's got stories about walking in his neighborhood, and I think one of the very earliest ones that I think of as Dick did was walking down a quiet neighborhood street where there are just blue glows of television from every one of the windows.
Fahrenheit
461, whatever.
105,
you know. So yeah, that is pretty
good. Can we jump back to Bozos?
Yeah.
I'd love to talk a little bit about that's the one that sticks with me in a predictive sense the most. Just the idea that there are the whole world is an amusement park full of things that are tracking you. Which is a really funny idea in 1971, and also kind of really paranoid. But I think you guys were just mostly interested in the technological aspect of it.
Well, yeah, but what's interesting about that album now, in retrospect, is that we predicted hackers, we predicted viruses, and we predicted how you could shut down an entire government. Really, by hacking it, how you could break down the president through basically a network of information, a social network, which it evolved into. But the thing that most impresses me about the effect of the Bozos album is if you have an iPhone and you say to Siri, "This is Worker speaking, hello," she will say back to you, "Hello, Aklem. What service can I perform for you?" Yeah, try it. You'll see. And the reason is, I did a lot of it. Both David and I worked in Pixar movies early in their career. David and I both did It's a Bug's Life, although Dave had a really nice part in that, opposite Phyllis Diller, right, Dave?
That's right. Well, never opposite her, only in the movies. You never worked with that.
That's right. Well, you never worked directly with other actors. You record separately. Steve Jobs bought into Pixar, okay? And so I met him at an opening night party, a cast and crew party up in San Francisco, for, I think it was for A Bug's Life. And he said to me when I met him, he said, I'm a big fan. And I said, well, that's wonderful. So apparently, he put this, I guess you'd call it an Easter egg, I don't know terminology, but he put this thing into Siri as an homage to the Fireside Theater. And also, if you say to her, if you ask her, why does the porridge bird lay his egg in the air? She will say to you, you can't shut me down that easily. Isn't that amazing? So that is an absolute result of the fact that it seemed to have inspired the Jobs in his creation of his computer empire, to develop the uses of home computer. So we did a good thing there, I think.
That's all very cool to me because, I mean, part of science fiction is science fiction have in common is that it's both about what people want and one becomes the other.
That's right. And it's very nice at Bradbury. I was able to go out to NASA, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory here in California, and take a look at the Mars landing robots and things that they were sending out before he passed away, because that, of course, is Martian Stories were a terrific vision. And the Martian Stories came about because of Norman Corwin.
That's right.
That's for you.
That's of course Norman Corwin, who was one of the great radio dramatists and
an inspiration to us all.
Yeah. Norman was 10 years older than Ray, and when Ray was still selling the stories to fantasy magazines, Norman said, you need to make a book out of these. And Bradbury said, really, out of these? And he said, make a book, and I'll sell it. And he did, and of course that also involved Forry Ackerman at the time. I think Forry was his agent, but anyway, he would not have done The Martian Chronicles had Norman Corwin not suggested that all of these stories laid in a particular order with a few little intervening passages would make a novel. And so
that's right.
Made him famous, made him instantly famous. I remember when I first met him, that was the only book that was out, was Martian Chronicles. And he just had a glow about him. Like, mm-hmm. Successful. Like the occasional movie star, that kind of successful person just has that glow. It's really quite something. I learned a lot just from that.
And he and Norman were friends right up to the end of their lives.
Oh, yes.
And many times, because I was down, I lived down here in Los Angeles, I was able to go to Ed's at the Writers Guild Theater, where both of the great men were present, celebrating Norman's 100th birthday, and bringing to life a screenplay that Ray Bradbury had written about Moby Dick that had never been presented before. And so I really got to spend time with both of those wonderful people in their last years.
Very inspirational, absolutely. The other thing about, that was just to go back to Bozo's, the environment of Bozo's, where this happens, is this festival or fair or as it's a
Disneyland, really, but
it is Disneyland. We were looking at that time. We had done an album about radio. We'd done an album about television, and I was casting about for some other form. And at one of our writing meetings, said, "What about Disneyland as a has something to write as a form,
as a meeting, a frame for the story, right?"
Yeah, and so we got further and further into the idea of the future fair as the medium in which all of these things would happen, and then they began to happen. We suddenly had the Bozo bus and the hologram characters. I mean, all of this was totally in our imagination at the time.
Yeah, but I was also inspired by the things that were happening around us. When I first came out here, one of the things that I did was that I worked in industrials, and the industrials were introducing the computer world, the business world, all right? as a tool. IBM was doing industrials for IBM, where they were teaching their staff how to use computers, okay, to forward their business, and because they were selling computers, how to teach other businesses buy their computers, basically. And there was a job fair here in Los Angeles that I wandered into. I found the ELIZA program, which was a very early interactive computer program that posited that you were a patient talking to a doctor, okay? And there was this printout. It was all you type something in and then they would type an answer. And there was this barrel filled with all of this paper from the day's interaction between people and this program. And I scooped up a pile of it and brought it in to the table every day and started reading from it. And it also had the code, the ASCII code or whatever they call it, so that you could see it would say, like, I'm happy MathNam and things like that. And Dr. Memory is direct readout memory. Direct readout memory, Dr. Memory. We got a lot of the language and the inspiration for the computer, the man behind the curtain, if you will, the workings of a computer from that particular program. And we built that into our writing and into the concept of the binary code and what this binary code would do. You know, the yes-no, which is an existential idea. That's what life is all about. You either live in a yes or you live in a no. These yes-no decisions really make your life. You know, that's what your life is. Yes,
or they turn you into a mental case when you can't decide to say yes, no. That's right. It allows them to get through to Dr. Memory and to deprogram the future fair, which
exactly.
Most of it just simply disappears because it was all an illusion to begin with.
That's right. That's right. The truer words were never spoken. And really, when you think about it, that's been the philosophy of the Fireside Theater in all of our opus, which is that you are responsible for your own life, and that you can become deprogrammed, and that you can be liberated from the barrage of media, and now the barrage of social media, the barrage of commercialism and propaganda around you by finding your own path and being brave enough to follow it or to speak out about it.
Good words, Phil. Good words. Are there any questions from the
I wanted to open it up for questions in a minute, but yeah, David, just tell me very quickly about the Mark Time Awards.
The Mark Time Awards are for radio or audio theater multicast productions. They have been given for 18 years for science fiction productions, and just this year we extended the award to include the Nick Danger Prize for mystery or detective fiction. We've added a prize honoring Peter Bergman, the Bradshaw, for contributions to the field. And we will be giving out these awards. Go to marktimeaward.org, I believe.
Oh, you forgot to tell you the Alaski Award.
I was getting to that.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
The final award was for actors, both actors in an ensemble cast and for an individual acting performance. And of course, Nancy, but everyone knows her as something else, don't they?
Well, everybody knows her as Nancy, but her real name is something like
Kalani.
Don't ask me, I only wrote it.
You only played the part.
So you played the part. I didn't write it, I just played the part, right.
You know, we all played Nancy. This is something nobody knows.
Yes.
on the original and on stage productions as well, but on the original recorded, you can hear all four of us at one time or another playing Nancy.
So yeah, in one scene, when we went back forward into the past, right, we ran out of, we didn't overdub or anything. We all had to, play the roles live in the studio. And so we all had to essay the role of Nancy. But of course, you can see that the album is that this was a transcription of a real Nick Danger radio show.
Yeah.
And at the time, the woman who was supposed to play Nancy, who was Mrs. Nancy, was drunk. Her nickname was Bottles, right? And so Soundman had to take over the role of Nancy. That was me. And then, of course, everybody else had to cover her when the time arose.
Yes, you can't play you and Nancy, Rocky and Nancy.
I couldn't play Rocky and Nancy. Right.
Guys, we have to bail in about 5 minutes. Maybe I can take some questions from the room for you. Anybody have any questions?
Yeah.
Talk about you hear me. Back to the Future, Forward into the Past, the Spielberg steel. Basically, Back to the Future, the title, and then you have Forward into the Past. Did Spielberg steal from those guys?
Back to the Future versus Forward into the Past. Is it possible Mr. Spielberg and Mr. Zemeckis lifted this concept from you?
Oh, gosh. You know, you can't copyright ideas. So, no. Yes, no. I think we inspired.
Fair enough.
You know, also, Spielberg used to hang out at the farm where Bergman was living.
Secret message to only the people in this room, Mr. Spielberg appears in one of the home movies on the DVD. Just for a second. Another question.
By the way, I think I should mention that the movie Everything You Know Is Wrong was done as a promotional film for CBS, for Columbia Records. So we had a very, very small budget. And that's when we decided that we would actually lip sync through the record, and that way we could ensure that we could get the thing in under budget. So that's one of the little secrets about that.
Cool. Okay, another question.
About 25 years ago, you were on some random comedy night on TV doing a Nick Danger episode ending with the one about the scent of rotting magnolia blossoms, and I don't know if that's ever been recorded anywhere. I have an antique, almost worn-out beta tape, and I would love to get that.
Evening at the Improv?
Yeah.
It had all four of the guys?
Evening at the Improv. That's right. We performed that piece where, David, you were Starsucker, right?
Yes. Yeah, it was the first new Nick Danger, mm-hmm. not the first, but it was the first one that we got on stage, and it was even more noir movie-like. That was it. The Improv and that circulating.
We did it at the Roxy, and then we did it at the Improv.
Yeah, we did it at the Roxy.
Yeah, that one may have to end up living on the web because it belongs to A&E. I'm not sure if we can license it, but it should live on YouTube at some point. At some point, we will get it together and have a YouTube channel, and we'll try and get all of that various amazing miscellaneous Firesign footage all into one channel. Any other questions?
Well, that'd be cool.
Please do.
Oh, yes. Well, if we got like 1 minute, you guys tell me a little bit about the Apocalypse Papers, because this is a chapbook that was published in a really small edition in 1976, and it's about to come out again. What do you guys remember about that?
Remember?
Doctor?
Remember? Yes.
Apocalypse Doctor?
The Apocalypse Papers. This was a guy in the Midwest who wanted to do a series of little chapbooks, science fiction chapbooks. And he had gotten Isaac Asimov, I think, to do the first one. Asimov was a very funny guy. He couldn't remember the last book that he had written. You know, he had read 400 books. We got in touch with him about something, and he said, I wrote that book so long ago, I don't even remember it. I've written 532 books. I'm still on my 530. It's very funny. But we did that. It was published in Topeka, Kansas, by a guy there, Type Bitten, and we each had wrote into a story which Bill Austin started, and then Phil Proctor and I kind of wrote into it, explicating his strange story, the incident is Phil Proctor's piece, which is the declaration from outer space. I think heavily derived from the Jurassic book, I think.
Nice.
I'll get it down in my office, and I'll go and read it, see if I can
remember what that is. And yeah, it was just another one of them. And then there's a wonderful piece of Peter's, which wasn't directly related to that, but it has to do with the electrician, who was our great science fiction villain, our, if you like, our serial villain. If we had done a series of, you know, we've done Columbia Pictures 13 episodes of the electrician versus whoever,
universe.
Indeed. Speaking of, bye. We're out of time. You guys, thank you so much for calling in. Thank you. Thank you, Freya, and thank you, Nat Sines, for having us here. It's been awesome. Yeah, I guess if you guys want to call back in at 11:45, if we can work it out, we can get you on the Q&A for after the movie.
That'll be fun.
Cool. Okay, I'll talk to you guys then.
Bye.
See ya.